This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for our review of the week in WMRA news. We've got some compelling stories in the next half hour, including our own Jordy Yeager's report after spending a night in a homeless shelter. The shelter is part of a coalition among religious congregations that work together to provide nighttime shelter during the winter months for the homeless in Charlottesville. We'll also have our analysis of the week's activity in the General Assembly, whose 2017 regular session has just ended. And we'll also go a little farther back in the Wayback Machine and compare how Republicans and Democrats have governed the state legislature when they've each been in the majority. But first, the Shenandoah Valley is one of the top destinations in the country for refugees from around the world. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz spoke with several people in Harrisonburg whose lives and work are being affected by the recent turmoil in immigration and refugee policy.
2 days after President Trump was sworn into office, Antoine and Antoinette, and two of their five children, arrived in the United States.
Thank you. Welcome to you.
Since 2004, this Congolese family lived as refugees in Burundi, a small country surrounded by Rwanda, Tanzania, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, fleeing war. Now they live in a Harrisonburg apartment east of Interstate 81. They asked us not to use their last names because they still have family in danger in Burundi. Although they personally feel much safer now, they're still very, very worried.
We left there, our children. They don't have any possibilities to live. And we stopped to pay the rent of the house. So they don't have anywhere to live.
Their two boys who came with them to the United States are already settling into public high school. But it wasn't until last week, after Trump's travel ban had caused his flight to be canceled, and then the ban was put on hold, and then his flight was rescheduled, that one of Antoine and Antoinette's three remaining adult children arrived. His name is Rika, speaking here with his father interpreting.
Okay. He said that we'll be happy if we are together with our families complete.
About his siblings still in Burundi, Rika said this.
Feeling bad because they are living in bad situation there. It's very difficult for them to eat, it's very difficult for them to sleep. And if they need something to eat, they must sell clothes. You are not happy because we are not complete. Yeah.
The family came to Harrisonburg through the Refugee Resettlement Program and the local Church World Service Immigration and Refugee Office. Rebecca Sprague, the agency's community program coordinator, says that the number of refugees allowed into the United States this fiscal year has been cut from President Obama's target of 110,000 to 50,000 under Trump's new policy. Since 30,000 people have already arrived, she says, that leaves slots for only 20,000 more. But there are already 67,000 people who are approved for flying here, which means 47,000 of those simply won't get to come. And that's with or without any executive travel ban. All of this is affecting the Harrisonburg Agency's work and possibly future funding.
Even once the travel starts again, the number that we're expected to resettle this year has dropped from 245 to 130. And since we're already at the 115 mark or something, it's only a few more families for the rest of the year if the number of refugees allowed into the country isn't increased.
Anxiety is increasing among the non-refugee immigrant population too, says Alicia Horst, executive director of New Bridges Immigrant Resource Center in Harrisonburg.
It feels like we're in uncharted territory when it comes to enforcement. It creates a lot of anxiety, even for persons that one would say, oh, you have nothing to worry about. A lawful permanent resident is somebody that you would normally say can travel and not need to question whether or not they have access to their family in the United States. But it feels like a whole new world in some ways of unknowns.
National news reporting has suggested a potential increase in enforcement action against immigration violations. Horst has known of immigration and customs enforcement activity here in the Valley over the years, but mainly only when people have been involved in criminal situations. The potential for workplace raids or broader sweeps is troubling, she says.
How those choices are made about who to ask for documentation are questions I would have. Are you asking any random person on the street, or are you asking persons that are connected to a particular building, and why is that?
Some in the community are pushing for Harrisonburg to become a sanctuary city. An online petition to the city council had about 1,500 signatures Monday. and the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia is among those calling for Governor McAuliffe, quote, not to accept responsibility on behalf of the Commonwealth for enforcing the federal government's immigration laws. Recent arrival and refugee Antoine, who simply doesn't know when his other two adult children will be able to join him here, has felt well received and has high hopes for his family's new life here.
People in America like the refugees. Our dreams is to walk and to make an America develop. Yeah.
Alicia Horst finds that sentiment refreshing.
Especially given a lot of what people have faced before they move here. To be able to say, I want to invest who I am in this place. And the hope of that, it's beautiful. I mean, I want my neighbors to be people exactly like that.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
In 2004, religious congregations in Charlottesville formed a coalition to prevent homeless people from freezing overnight in the winter. Today, that group shelters more than 200 people, 150 nights out of the year. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this report.
It's 5:30 on a near-freezing winter evening.
You ready?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
Oops, excuse me, gentlemen. Come on in.
Every night during the coldest months of the year, the basement door at the Haven swings open, welcoming Charlottesville's homeless. Located in an old downtown church, the Haven is a day shelter, but it's also the point of entry for an off-site overnight shelter known as Pacham. Tonight, Pacham is home to 45 men.
You know what? I'm going to be honest with you. You're talking about 45 different paths.
Brian Henderson is an intake supervisor at Pacham. He says there's no one face of homelessness.
Some folks, it's about just making sure I stay alive for the day. Some folks have, you know, chemical dependence where in all actuality, you know, if I don't have that drink, you know, I might not make it to the next day, you know? You got some folks that are working. You got some folks that are really on the grind. They're attempting to find work. They're filling out applications. You got some guys that are flagging and flying signs.
During the day, Brian works at the city's Department of Social Services. He knows more about these guys than most. Tonight, he's doing intake.
So essentially, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is your priority.
With everyone accounted for, a fleet of large vans pulls up outside. The men go to one shelter, the women to another. The few couples there are kiss each other goodnight, and they're off. Pacham is an acronym that stands for People and Congregations Engaged in Ministry. Every week or two, from October through March, a different house of worship opens its doors to the homeless. Tonight, the men are at First Presbyterian Church on Park Street. On one half of the church's large fellowship hall are 45 cots. On the other side are a dozen dining tables. Church volunteers help serve the guys a different meal each night.
You want salad?
Tonight, it's chili, cornbread, and salad. Jennifer Jones has been volunteering with the church for nearly a decade.
I think when you sit down next to them and eat dinner, or you play a game of cards with them, or my son at 5 years old learning to shoot hoops, they taught him how to play spades, you realize that they're normal people just like you and I, and they all have a story, and it just, they're human beings.
After dinner, some of the men walk over to the old carriage house where they can shower in privacy. A James Bond film plays in the common room, and Jones's son Nathan, who's now 14, helps them do laundry. Every season, there are new faces and guys who return. Nathan says they become an extended family of sorts, giving him a sense of safety and comfort when they're around. He realizes, though, not everyone may feel that way. There's a stigma to homelessness, says Don Grigorchek, the executive director of Pacham. People who have never been houseless have common misperceptions about people who are.
That they're lazy. I hear that, and that's wrong. That is so wrong. It is so hard to live on the street. You have to be so resourceful.
The guys I talked to at Pacham, they agree. They also say there's an empathy gap.
They should jump in our shoes for like a month.
Ricky's 51 years old and been homeless 3 times.
You gotta sleep outside for a couple months and see how you like it. Get your sleeping bag. You can have your sleeping bag, but you gotta sleep on the side of the road. They'll have better understanding. They'll be more humble. They'll have better understanding what we're going through. Because a lot of them don't know what we're going through. They see us with the homeless sign. They think we're lying, but then some people have a homeless sign. They go smoke drugs or get to drinking. They only drink to come to misery. What's going on up here? That's why they drink.
Another guest named Christopher, in his late 30s, agrees.
Not all of us homeless people are trash. I'm a computer technician. I've got an IQ of 168. And I'm just down on my luck. So don't judge us by what we look like. Don't judge us by where we're at. You could be here too.
Christopher's never been homeless before. And Grigorchuk explains that really the only difference between me and him is that I still have a network of family and friends to bail me out in times of crisis. For these guys, for one reason or another, their social safety net is gone.
That's another reason why I like working here, is because I feel like we, the community, are stepping in and we're saying, okay, your family couldn't do it, but we can. You know, we're your family. We're here in Charlottesville and we're helping each other.
Back at the church, 11 o'clock means lights out. Many of the guys are already in bed. The day's exhaustion has settled in. The snores get louder. Conversations quieter. And Pacham staff hunkers down for the night. Shortly before 6, they get their first wake-up call. The music starts. And by 6:30, they're out the door. For some, it's off to work. For others, it's back to the Haven. Some hustle to make it through the day. Others are one step closer to getting off the streets. There's a difference between being homeless and houseless. These men may not have a house right now, but whether it's one night, one week, or one season, Pacham makes sure they've always got a home. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
The regular session of this year's General Assembly is over, and Democrats in Richmond have complained that the Republican majority has used underhanded tactics to push their legislative agenda, steamrolling bills by not scheduling hearings, killing proposals in unrecorded votes. But what happened when Democrats were in control? Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has this look at the way things worked in the era of Democratic rule.
Democrats controlled Virginia's House of Delegates for more than a century, from Reconstruction to the new millennium. Republicans were finally able to seize power in 1999, and they've been in power ever since. But talk to Republicans who remember what it was like to be in the minority, and they all say the same thing.
The Democrats, when they were in control, ruled really an iron fist.
Republican Speaker Bill Howell arrived as a minority freshman back in 1988.
When you were assigned your seat on the dais in the committee room, they wouldn't let the Republicans sit together. And this was before the days of cell phone. They brought out walkie-talkies, and they were communicating to one another with walkie-talkies.
One infamous part of Democratic rule Speaker Howell says he witnessed firsthand was the rule of three, when longtime Democratic Majority Leader Dickie Cranwell heard something he didn't like on the other side of the aisle. Howell says he would hold up three fingers, and the next three Republican bills would die, regardless of what they were about. For the record, Cranwell denies this, but Howell says...
I saw that happen on... some occasions. That's the way they did it. I don't think that's the way to do it. And yes, I'm sure the minority feels that the majority now overreaches.
While Speaker Howell might not have his own rule of three now that he's in charge, Democrats are certainly finding examples of what they call overreach. A couple weeks ago, they held a press conference complaining about how Republicans were killing bills without even scheduling them for a hearing. Democratic delegate Ken Plum, the longest-serving House member, says Republicans are just as bad as Democrats when they were in power, maybe worse.
We heard a lot of complaints about that for a lot of years, about how bad Democrats were when they were doing that, and now we find that that is happening in many committees across the Capitol, and, for example, most recently the P&E Committee, where they dispensed with the redistricting bills in one motion.
Plum says that since Republicans seized power, they've come up with their own tactics, like shooting down bills in small subcommittees with unrecorded votes.
Four people out of the 140 members of the House of Delegates, four people decided the outcome and fate of those bills. I don't recall that in the old days.
But Republicans who remember life in the minority disagree. Republican leader Kirk Cox says that when he arrived at the Capitol in 1990, he couldn't get anything past the majority. He recalls one time having one of his bills assigned to a committee that never met.
I literally waited till 1 o'clock in the morning. The chairman told me my bill was going to subcommittee 5, and I go, God, I wish they'd have told me that like at 11 o'clock. But okay, I get that. And everyone's chuckling in the audience, and I sort of ask them, why is everyone chuckling? They go, there is no subcommittee number 5.
When Democrats were in control, committee meetings would often stretch late into the night. and the Courts of Justice Committee they would call the final deadline evening the Night of the Long Knives, a reference to the hundreds of bills that would be killed, sometimes in a block vote without a hearing. Democratic delegate Vivian Watts says when Republicans took control, they changed that.
In the early years, the only real difference between the Republicans being in control and the Democrats being in control is that when you had a 7 o'clock meeting, it was at a civilized hour of 7 p.m., not 7 a.m.
Instead of long meetings that stretch late into the night, she says Republicans meet early in the morning and kill bills much more efficiently and with much less public input.
Well, it may be just a matter of sort of a different lifestyle approach to things. It does freeze out the public.
So was the era of Democratic rule any worse than the way Republicans run the House of Delegates today? Here's how Speaker Howell answers that question.
Well, I'm sure we both have room for improvement.
Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
And now it's time to sharpen our focus on Virginia politics with a look back at the past week. Craig Carper with our partner station WCVE in Richmond spoke with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, for some analysis of this week's political activity in Virginia.
Well, Jeff, longtime Speaker of the House Bill Howell has announced his retirement. He's served in the legislature for 30 years, 15 as Speaker, and longtime Speaker in waiting, Majority Leader Kirk Cox, has been elevated to Speaker designee.
No surprise that Cox would be selected by the Republican majority as Speaker. There have been some interested parties other than Cox, but not many of them have been able to match Cox in terms of inspiring the loyalty and support of the Republican rank and file. Cox came into the legislature in 1990. He has coached many legislators and legislative candidates on how to win and how to get reelected. And he's further inspired their loyalty by raising money for them and steering money to them, over $1 million as majority leader, a very serious-minded legislator from the Colonial Heights, Chesterfield area. But what I think is really interesting about his selection is that the selection is being made now, before the primary, before the election, before January 2018, when the legislature will return and organize anew. And I wonder if that has something to do with the uncertain political landscape that we see this year, in large part because of Donald Trump. So perhaps the Republicans can say, now we are fully organized, we are in lockstep, we are unified. Now we get on with the business of defending seats, particularly defending Republican House seats in suburban areas where hostility to Trump is greatest. And in a state in which there is an increasingly national electorate. So one wonders, and one hears this from Republicans, that if the president's disapproval ratings keep climbing or his negatives keep climbing, that perhaps people are going to take that out on anyone with an R after his or her name.
And lawmakers have apparently completed their Herculean task of closing a $1.5 billion shortfall. Conferees announced their budget compromise earlier this week.
And I wonder if a big part of this budget is tied into that big concern that Republicans have about Trump and Trump-related fallout. This is a budget that, despite this $1.5 billion hole that has been closed, will include pay raises for public employees, essentially at every level of government. State police, civil service employees, teachers, college professors. Here's something that Republicans can talk about that really isn't partisan. It's practical. And it's a story that Republicans can tell all across Virginia. Again, perhaps in anticipation of some pushback from voters over Trump and what he's trying to do up in Washington. So I think that the budget should be viewed as something of an important political instrument in an unusual House and gubernatorial election year.
And for the last 6 weeks, we've heard a good deal of talk about immigration. I suspect several of these bills will be referenced heavily in campaign brochures in the fall.
And we certainly saw a little bit of gubernatorial politics play out on the floor of the Senate earlier this week when Tommy Norman, the Republican majority leader, engineered a tie vote on this anti-immigrant bill, forcing the lieutenant governor to cast a vote against it, allowing the Republicans to trash him as immigrant friendly. I don't know that that's necessarily a negative for a Democrat these days, particularly in a changing Virginia. But it was a reminder that, you know, politics, campaign politics, election year campaign politics, driving a lot of what's going on in Richmond.
And what do guns, abortion, and Tim Tebow have in common, Jeff?
Campaign year politics. The governor is standing firm, and a Democratic governor standing firm in his resistance to further loosening of the gun laws, further assault on abortion rights, and the Tebow bill making sure that public school sports programs remain closed to homeschoolers. All of these bills are articles of faith with the Republican right, and that they were vetoed certainly consistent with the expectations of liberal Democrats.
And campaign financiers, start your engines. Donors should be getting out their checkbooks.
If you are Ralph Northam, who hasn't been able to raise money for the past 46 days, now you are fully unencumbered, as are the Republican and Democratic members of the House, will be standing for re-election. The primary season begins in earnest when the Speaker's gavel falls, and one will quite literally see the invitations for fundraisers going out by email as soon as this session concludes.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, we will catch up again next week.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Biv and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Pam and Jim Huggins, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll be off for a few days, so I'll talk to you next week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.